Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 427, Tuesday, May 31st, 2022.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. So I'm going to read a short piece to you from science fiction author Cory Doctorow. And I read it because it was supposedly about cryptocurrencies, and it was, I thought, going to be a generalized criticism of them. And I respect Cory Doctorow. I trust him to deal fairly with the topic. So, you know, I was reading it as a good faith check-in with the loyal opposition, you might say. It turns out that the piece wasn't really about what I thought it was going to be about. And in order to set up, I think, a full appreciation of what it actually turns out to be about, I'm going to read to you a little bit from Wikipedia about the company WeWork. It's all one word, but capital W's. Capital W-E, capital W-O-R-K, WeWork. They were in the news a couple years ago. And if you don't recall the specifics, well, that's why I'm going to read what's here at the top of the Wikipedia entry on WeWork. WeWork, Inc. is a provider of co-working spaces, including physical and virtual shared spaces, headquartered in New York City. As of December 31st, 2021, the company operated 44.8 million square feet, 4,160,000 square meters of space, including 19.8 million square feet. And y'all can convert that to metric if you want to. I'm not going to read the parenthetical metric equivalents anymore. Including 19.8 million square feet in the United States and Canada in 756 locations in 38 countries and had 590,000 members with a weighted average commitment term of 20 months. The company gained mainstream media attention in 2019 with its failed initial public offering of company stock. The Wall Street Journal noted that upon release of its public prospectus in August of 2019, the company was, quote, besieged with criticism over its governance, business model, and ability to turn a profit, close quote. In September 2019, following mounting pressure from investors based on disclosures WeWork had made in its S-1 filing for the IPO, company co-founder Adam Neumann resigned from his position as CEO and gave up majority voting control in WeWork. Amid growing investor concerns over its corporate governance, valuation, and outlook for the business, WeWork formally withdrew its S-1 filing and announced the postponing of its IPO. At the time, the reported public valuation of the company was around $10 billion U.S., a reduction from the $47 billion valuation it had achieved in January and less than the $12.8 billion it had raised since 2010. As of May 2022, the company is traded at a valuation of $5.1 billion. In October 2019, Adam Neumann received close to $1.7 billion U.S. dollars from stakeholder SoftBank for stepping down from WeWork board and severing most of his ties to the company. So he got paid $1.7 billion to quit. He was retained as a consultant with the annual salary of $46 million. The New York Times described the company's failed effort to go public and its related turmoil as, quote, an implosion unlike any other in the history of startups, close quote, which it attributed to Neumann's questionable tenure and the easy money previously provided to him by SoftBank. So that's what comes before the table of contents in Wikipedia. So I just want to repeat, this guy, Adam Neumann, you're going to learn more about some of his shady dealings in the piece by Cory Doctorow I'm about to read. But after all his shady dealings and his failed attempt to take the company public, he got paid $1.7 billion to step down from the board and to sever most of his ties to the company, although they retained him as a consultant with an annual salary of $46 million. Again, this person's name is Adam Neumann. So now, reading a piece by Cory Doctorow. This is from May 27th, 2022. It's from the website pluralistic.net, which I think is Cory Doctorow's personal website. Cory Doctorow writes, WeWork founder raises $70 million for blockchain-based voluntary carbon credits. Even crypto's biggest boosters admit that the industry has a scam problem. This is especially hard to deny now that hundreds of billions of real dollars worth of fake stablecoins have gone up in smoke. So, stepping out of the article, that's the Terra Luna stablecoin. I don't feel qualified to describe exactly how it failed. That would require more research, and I'm not going to do that in time to include in this episode. Maybe for the future, let me know if you're interested. Going back to Cory Doctorow. Crypto apologists will tell you that there are scams everywhere, and they're not wrong. The productive economy has been systematically dismantled and replaced with financialized grifts. Private equity, REITs, SPACs, MLMs, ad fraud, and monopoly. That means the only way to save for retirement, health emergencies, or your kid's college education is to roll the dice in a crooked casino where the house always wins. But even at this moment of peak scam, crypto stands out as especially scammy. There are some structural factors behind that. For one thing, crypto is complex. In fact, it's doubly complex because things like smart contracts can only be truly understood if you can read source code and a prospectus, and most people understand neither. Complexity is a fraudster's best friend. Anytime someone adds complexity to a proposition bet, I'll pay you X if Y happens, you should assume that the complexity exists solely to obscure the true odds and rope you into a sucker's wager. Then there's the pseudonymity and anonymity. Anonymity is key to the right to privacy, but when you combine anonymity with finance, not the right to speak anonymously, but the right to run an investment fund anonymously, you're rolling out the red carpet for serial scammers who can run a scam, get caught, change names, and run it again, incorporating the lessons they learned. Go through the Web3 is going great archive for scams, and you'll see that crypto implosions are rarely one-offs. Typically, the fraudsters, who steal millions from crypto gamblers, are repeat offenders who've refined their grifts through a series of crimes that they were able to outrun by assuming new identities. When you can't understand the nature of a financial product, and you can't know for sure who is offering it, you need some other rule of thumb for determining whether you should gamble your savings on it. The big one here is transitive trust. I trust this person, and this person says this new coin or product is great, so I'll trust that too. Maybe you trust Larry David, or Matt Damon, or Madonna, or Reese Witherspoon, or Gwyneth Paltrow, or Spike Lee, or Bill Self, or Paris Hilton, or Tom Brady, or Mila Kunis, or Aaron Rodgers, or Stephen Curry, or Mark Cuban, or Shaquille O'Neal, or Serena Williams, or Justin Bieber, or Eminem, or Jimmy Fallon, or Logan Paul, or Snoop Dogg, or... ellipse. Of course, it's easy to explain why you might not trust celebrities to give you financial advice. Being good at acting or sports or music doesn't mean you're good at finance. Think of all those stories of celebs who die in poverty after squandering their millions. But it's not just celebs who endorse cryptocurrency and related products. Some of the biggest names behind new crypto offerings are A-list investors whose entire public persona is based on their incredible financial acumen. These investors, including the all-star A16Z, formerly Andreessen Horowitz, have firmly established that they back cryptos based on whether they can make money and get out, not on whether the company they're investing in is offering a sound, sustainable product. For A16Z, bets on wildly unstable stablecoins or imploding wildly unfun games like Axie Infinity are sound investments, not because these firms have any future, but because coin offerings are unregulated securities that let investors cash out before the companies collapse. Even amid this pump-and-dump ethos, one of A16Z's investments stands out as especially cynical. The firm led a $70 million Series A investment in Flow Carbon, a voluntary carbon market, VCM, cryptocurrency, led by Adam Neumann, the notorious WeWork founder whose unethical conduct and misleading statements scuttled the $47 billion IPO. There were lots of things wrong with WeWork, and Neumann was behind all of them. Protoss provides some of Neumann's greatest hits. Running a business culture shot through with substance abuse. rampant self-dealing, including rental real estate to his own company, and extracting his investors' cash by offering himself below-market loans out of the company's coffers. This one's my favorite. Filing a personal trademark on the word we, and then charging his own company a $6 million licensing fee to use it. He eventually refunded this after public outrage. Protoss doesn't mention Newman's most relevant misconduct, though, employing a non-standard valuation scheme that allowed him to falsely claim that his company was worth $47 billion. At the time, I felt this was obviously fraud, and subsequent events bore out this assessment. Despite Newman's manifest untrustworthiness and his history of capital-destroying financial shenanigans, A16Z, again formerly Andreessen Horowitz, has helped him raise $70 million. Remember, if you don't understand crypto products and you don't know much about business people, you are forced to rely on the judgments of celebrity investors like A16Z to guide your financial decisions. Newman's new venture, Flow Carbon, will only be profitable if naive retail investors also buy into it. Flow Carbon's main product is a speculative crypto asset called the Goodness Nature Token, GNT. What is a GNT? It is meant to represent, quote, a non-binding, self-created carbon offsets for excess pollution, close quote. Basically a carbon offset. Now, carbon offsets are already incredibly scammy. Large firms deal in tens of millions of dollars worth of carbon credits that represent, for example, forests whose owners have pledged not to log them. But in many cases, these are forests that would never be logged because they're owned by a wilderness trust, say. In other cases, the forests have burned down, but the credits for not logging them are still being traded. Flow Carbon's goal is to take this market for lemons and make it bigger and faster to facilitate, quote, price transparency, liquidity, and accessibility, close quote. The target customers are DAOs, or distributed autonomous organizations, and DeFi projects, especially ones using planet-destroying proof-of-work systems like Ethereum and Bitcoin. These projects will be able to buy carbon credits based on even shakier promises of carbon offsetting and claim that they are carbon neutral. As Protoss points out, the traditional finance markets for these voluntary offsets have failed spectacularly. Companies like the Chicago Climate Exchange, CCX, tanked and took their investors' capital with them. The major distinction between Flow Carbon and CCX is being Web3, bro, and being helmed by a man whose funny accounting and self-dealing cost his investors $47 billion. Okay, I'm going to pause here. I'm going to read more, but I'm going to pause and just say, when we talk about these spectacular business failures, which take down $47 billion worth of investor capital, that $47 billion didn't get destroyed. It was transferred to the accounts of human beings and corporations. You know, you talk about the collapse of a company. It's not like the collapse of a building. You know, when a building collapses, the building isn't there anymore. When a company collapses, yeah, the company's not there anymore, but the capital wasn't destroyed. The capital got transferred to somebody. And as Wikipedia told us, Adam Newman got paid tens of millions of dollars to step away from his collapsing enterprise, and then got paid tens of millions more every year to stay on as a consultant. Adam Newman's business ventures have failed spectacularly, but he personally has succeeded spectacularly in strictly monetary terms. He's made a shit ton of money failing. So, Cory Doctorow continues. A16Z and Flow Carbon insist that this will all be very successful. There will be a long line of people with sound carbon offsets converting them to goodness tokens and listing them on Flow Carbon's exchange, and an equally long line of environmentally concerned DAOs buying the goodness tokens. Their pitch to you, the person hoping to retire without freezing or starving to death, is that you should buy the goodness tokens now, get on the waiting list, and hold goodness tokens against the day that they shoot up in value as Adam Newman, the $47 billion failure who nevertheless walked away with $480 million of his investors' money, leads the company to glory. Even worse, the scam at the core of Flow Carbon is carbon offsets. Flow Carbon's mission is to allow other businesses to claim to be good for the planet based on dubious carbon offset products. On one side of Flow Carbon's market, you have investors being lured into buying dubious tokens. On the other side, you have customers of companies who are lured into buying their products because they believe them to be good for the planet. Two-sided markets are the darling of the tech investor set. From Uber to Amazon, tech investors correctly understand that there are fortunes to be made from choke point capitalism, where a firm corners a market and extracts rent from buyers and sellers who can't reach each other otherwise. Okay, pausing again, just for editorial comment. Here's an example of what he's talking about. Suppose you know somebody who started a company making, well, say, a special kind of shoe. And you go to Amazon.com and you type in the specific name of your friend's company and the specific design of the shoe that you want into Amazon's search engine. If your friend hasn't paid Amazon to rank up in their search results, even if you're searching for their specific product, Amazon's not going to show it to you. They will show you competing products, or more likely, if it's a really successful product, Amazon will have made its own knockoff, and that's what's going to come up in the top of the search rankings. Choke point capitalism. You are the customer, you are trying to connect with the supplier of a particular good or service that you want, but there's an intermediary between you, and the intermediary won't allow you to connect with the person who's got the thing that you want, or allow the person who's got the thing that you want to connect with you, the customer, unless intermediary gets paid. Cory Doctorow continues. With Flow Carbon, we see true innovation in two-sided market design. Usually, these markets are only an obviously bad deal for one side of the market. For example, Spotify gives listeners access to a lot of music at a low price, while robbing musicians. Long-term, Spotify also rips off listeners, too, of course. But Flow Carbon has proposed a two-sided market that's a bad deal for both sides. Seen in that light, Adam Neumann is the perfect leader for this business. WeWork was sold as a platform for other businesses to run on. Flow Carbon is a scam that is also a platform for scams. Scams that roast the planet and bankrupt desperate retail investors who naively assume that what's good for A16Z is good for them. Hey, everybody. It's now early afternoon. The segment that you just heard was recorded in the early morning. The sun hadn't even really come up yet. And I was recording at that time because it's Arkansas. It's almost the end of May. It gets hot during the daytime. And I've got a window unit air conditioner right next to where I record. So I wanted to record in the morning when it was cool. But I didn't realize it at the time. Maybe I even realized it subconsciously and appreciated the beauty of it. But the birds are going crazy at that hour. And then I tried to filter out, you know, the ambient sounds, which didn't really filter out the birds. It just made them less recognizable as birds. So if it sounded like there was a little desktop Android or something beeping at me furiously while I was talking, no, it's just birds outside my window. Anyway, I had posted a link to that Cory Doctorow piece to my Patreon account, and Rick responded with the following. Just finished the same read and pretty much agree with your assessment. Oh, I suppose I need to read my assessment. Okay, so I posted a link to that piece that I just read to you on Patreon. And then as a comment, I wrote, okay, now that I've read this, I find that it's not what I was expecting. Doctorow doesn't deal so much with crypto in general as with the specific sins of one Adam Neumann, the former CEO of WeWork, a corporation that manages co-working spaces. I had thought that the company imploded. It still exists, it's just that its IPO failed. The general points that Doctorow is making in the piece zero in on the problems associated with anonymity and pseudonymity. Scammers who get caught just create a new identity and run the same scam all over again. Maybe they incorporate some lessons from the failure of their previous scams, but when you can just create a new identity and start again, learning from past mistakes is optional. So that last bit, Cory Doctorow didn't say that in the piece, that's my editorializing. To which Rick responded, just finished the same read and pretty much agree with your assessment. I would like to see more serious critiques of crypto, especially regarding the tech. Although I do appreciate Corey's calling attention to A16Z, and let me repeat, A16Z is the rebranding of a very well-known venture capital firm called Andreessen Horowitz. I imagine you've heard of them. But if you want to find them online now, their website is A16Z, or Z for you Commonwealth listeners, .com. And here's how they describe themselves. It's just three paragraphs. This is from their website. This is their words. This is the venture capital firm that is backing this carbon flow, you know, goodness token crypto shell game. I think that's a mild enough term. Founded in Silicon Valley in 2009 by Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, Andreessen Horowitz, known as A16Z, is a venture capital firm that backs bold entrepreneurs building the future through technology. We are stage agnostic. We invest in seed to venture to late-stage technology companies across bio plus healthcare, consumer, crypto, enterprise, fintech, games, and companies building toward American dynamism. A16Z has $33.3 billion in assets under management across multiple funds. A16Z, and the A is lowercase even when it's at the start of a sentence, A16Z is defined by respect for the entrepreneur and the company building process. We know what it's like to be in the founder's shoes. The firm is led by general partners, many of whom are former founders slash operators, CEOs or CTOs of successful technology companies, and who have domain expertise ranging from biology to crypto to distributed systems to security to marketplaces to financial services. Our team is at the forefront of new technology, helping founders and their companies impact and change the world. We aim to connect entrepreneurs, investors, executives, engineers, academics, industry experts, and others in the technology ecosystem. We have built a network of experts, including technical and executive talent, top media and marketing resources, Fortune 500 Global 2000 companies, as well as other technology decision makers, influencers, and key opinion leaders. A16Z uses this network as part of our commitment to help our portfolio companies grow their businesses. So our operating teams provide entrepreneurs with access to expertise and insights across the entire spectrum of company building. What they don't tell you there is what you had to hear from Cory Doctorow via me, most likely, that Andreessen Horowitz, a.k.a. A16Z, is quite happy to put money, you know, to raise investment funds for what is clearly a scam, and which something they know is going to have no long-term value whatsoever, but they are going to cash out before the whole thing falls apart. Basically, they're putting in their money and their clients' money in order to signal to retail investors, which is to say just normal people looking to, you know, catch a piece of the financialized economy. They see the big players putting their money in and they follow, and then the big players get out before the rug gets pulled out from everybody else. But Andreessen Horowitz, this is about as respectable as you get in terms of venture capital firms. And they are, you know, they're on board with this, which you're getting it from a prejudiced source. But I don't think it's too crazy to call a project which is really carbon offsets crossed with crypto, dreamed up by the guy who tried to take WeWork public, you know, with a valuation of $47 billion when its actual real, you know, reality-based valuation is more like $5 billion. To call that a scam, sure, you know, it's an unproved charge, but it doesn't really stretch credulity, does it? Okay, so I'm just going to start Rick's response over again because I got derailed before I got very far into it. Rick, responding to the Cory Doctorow piece, writes, "Just finished the same read and pretty much agree with your assessment. I would like to see more serious critiques of crypto, especially regarding the tech. Although I do appreciate Cory's calling attention to A16Z's investing in Adam Neumann, just finished listening to a Bankless podcast with A16 founder Mark Andreessen and the head of their crypto investing, Chris Dixon," and then he posts a link to this. "I haven't listened to this episode yet, but I intend to the next time I'm drawing." Rick continues, "They both come from technical and entrepreneurial backgrounds, but are definitely VCs, where the C stands for capitalist. Ha! They present a compelling picture of where Web3 is heading, how it relates to the founding of the internet, and address critiques of crypto slash Web3, and how some of these critiques are not necessarily new and unique to crypto slash Web3. Of course, they aren't going to mention questionable backgrounds of any of the people in whom they invest, so I am glad you shared the Doctorow article. Cryptography and security expert Bruce Schneerer," and I've been looking at his name for over a decade, and I still don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It's S-C-H-N-E-I-E-R. "Cryptography and security expert Bruce Schneerer is a big critic of crypto, but again, not because of the tech. His biggest beef seems to be that crypto advocates claim that their systems are trustless. which he claims is impossible since there is no such thing as a completely trustless system. I am also planning on listening to your latest podcast project. Sounds like there is going to be a decent amount of crypto/Web3-related content, In parentheses. Also, sounds like you get to be treated like the real talent in that project, with producers, writers, tech support, etc. So what he's talking about in that last paragraph is the Padverb podcast, and there's no writers. I mean, my intros and outros are just off the cuff, like they are with all my other podcast projects. I don't write anything down, and certainly nobody writes anything for me. But yeah, we do have producers who are booking the guests, and from my perspective, that's the most important part, but also very much appreciated is Slava, who, you know, is only taking a producer credit, but he also does a lot of audio engineering and editing work and, you know, post-production, which is very time-consuming, and I am very happy to have that lifted, you know, from my list of duties. And, you know, not to put it at the bottom of the list, but it's got to go somewhere, I'm also getting paid to do it, you know, so yeah, it feels good to be able to do an interview that somebody else set up for me and somebody else is going to edit and somebody else is going to post and then, you know, submit an invoice for it and get paid. That's very nice. So if any of you haven't listened to it yet, there is only one posted episode of the Padverb podcast, but you can find it at the Padverb website, which I'm not really sure how this works, and I should have looked it up before I started talking about it, but the URL is en.padverb.com. And if you scroll to the bottom of the main page, you'll see a link that says podcast. And that's where you'll find the Padverb podcast, hosted by yours truly. All right, because Rick mentioned Web3 repeatedly in the comment that I just read, I figure I should define it for you, because I think I've been using it without having first offered a definition, even before reading Rick's comment. So, in the evolution of the internet, the first iteration was the read-only web. And not the internet, because the internet is older than the World Wide Web. The World Wide Web, you know, is the, it's the internet with pictures and sound and video, but mostly just pictures and text when it first got rolling, you know, in the even before Netscape Navigator, there was Mosaic. Yes, that was the first web browser that I used, was the Mosaic browser. And I'm sure I've mentioned this on podcasts before, but when I first started using the World Wide Web, I was doing so at a computer lab in Columbia, Missouri, at the University of Missouri, and I would find articles that I wanted to read, and I would print them out and put them in a binder and take them home and read them on paper. So that was my initial use of the web. But within a year or so, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. So that was the read-only web. Basically, there was this thing called the World Wide Web, and you could search for stuff and maybe, you know, find stuff and read it. Cool, huh? The next iteration of the web was the writable web. So not only could you find stuff and read stuff on the web or access information, you could also interact with people. You could post comments. You could, like with LiveJournal or MySpace or, you know, early Facebook, you could post stuff that other people could see and interact with. Web 3, well, I'll get to that in a minute. First, the distinction between the read-only web and the writable web. Clearly, somebody had to be able to write to the read-only web. And, you know, within a year or so of my discovering that there was such a thing as the World Wide Web, I had a web page. It was called crealm.com. But it was no trivial task to build it. You know, I went and I bought a book on HTML, a book that actually included a CD in the back that had various HTML tags, you know, just already formatted for you. You just plug in your own content. And I used that to build the first iteration of the CRealm website. That was in probably 1995, I'm thinking. So you could write to the read-only web. It's just, it was a big ask. It was a high hurdle. Whereas, you know, when social media came along, or when you could comment on things, you know, on articles and in newspaper websites and things like that, then it was just a routine thing that lots of people did. So that was Web 2. Web 3 goes by a lot of different names, and it actually has some, I wouldn't say incompatible, but, you know, it has different definitions that don't really overlap all that clearly with one another. But I've selected two. And these are short, and these are from pretty neutral sources. So these are not the evangelists for Web3 describing how it's going to overthrow the powers that be and, you know, drive the shape-shifting reptilian overlords back to their own dimension or anything like that. This first one is from Harvard Business Review. And the powers that be, you know, are pretty skeptical, if not outright hostile to crypto. You know, certainly the Financial Times is really dismissive of cryptocurrencies and the people who are interested in them. But this is from the Harvard Business Review, and this is a summary of a longer article. So it's just one paragraph. Web3 is being touted as the future of the internet. The vision for this new blockchain-based web includes cryptocurrencies, NFTs, DAOs, or decentralized autonomous organizations, decentralized finance, and more. It offers a read, write, own version of the web, in which users have a financial stake in and more control over the web communities they belong to. Web3 promises to transform the experience of being online as dramatically as PCs and smartphones did. It is not, however, without risk. Some companies have entered the space only to face a backlash over the environmental impact and financial speculation and potential for fraud that comes with Web3 projects. And while blockchain is offered as a solution to privacy, centralization, and financial exclusion concerns, it has created new versions of many of these same problems. Companies need to consider both the risks and the benefits before diving in. So, again, this is not a booster's definition, which is why I think it's one you can take seriously. Okay, so this definition is from PC Mag, and it's actually an answer to the question of what is Web3 used for. PC Mag writes, "Proponents envision Web3 as an internet that does not require us to hand over personal information to companies like Facebook and Google in order to use their services. The web would be powered by blockchain technology and artificial intelligence, with all information published on the public ledger of the blockchain." And this was published in February 15th, 2022. So a fairly new take. I'm not seeing an example or a definition that includes this now, but I've also heard Web3 described as the executable web. So originally the web was read-only, then it was read-write, and now it's going to be read-write-execute. And also that PC Mag definition did touch on AI. Web3 has also been described as the semantic web, where, you know, in the past, algorithms were absolutely dumb. They had no clues as to, you know, context or the subtleties of word use, and they would make, you know, obvious blunders in distinguishing what's relevant from what's not, you know, in your search query. With the rise of, obviously not AGI, we're not at artificial general intelligence or even close to it yet, but algorithms are getting more competent, they are getting more subtle and agile, you know, in their ability to parse human speech, natural human speech, and natural human language, you know, when typed. So for some people, that is a key aspect of Web3, that the web as it is curated for you becomes much more expertly curated. But typically when people invoke Web3 in a discussion of cryptocurrencies and blockchain and that sort of thing, they're talking about the executable web and the one that is, you know, it's very, the web and the internet in general have always overrepresented the libertarian mindset. You know, the internet has always been far more libertarian than the general populace. And that's, I think, because a lot of the early innovators, you know, had a libertarian streak. A lot of them were living in California. Remember the Californian ideology, that weird mix of, you know, that mix of the rugged individualist and the libertarian mindset mixed with hippie psychedelia. So, you know, even within one company, say at Google or Facebook or Twitter, you're going to have people writing code, programmers, engineers, who have a very libertarian mentality, and they are going to coexist in the same company, which have HR departments, you know, which are the blue-haired, you know, the stereotype, I won't go on, you know, existing within the same company. So it's very much like the U.S. federal government or any other large sprawling organization, which is so big that it has various factions within it, which are sometimes antagonistic toward one another. There are lots of people, you know, at Twitter who are keeping it under their hats for the moment, but who are very happy to have Elon Musk take over. The ones who are really vocally upset about it, they're one faction, but they're not the whole company. All right, so on the topic of crypto and scams, I regularly, I'm talking multiple times a week, get unsolicited contacts from people who claim to be attractive young Asian women. And it's always the same script. Like, the details change, you know, the names change, but it's always they're reaching out to say hey to somebody that they already know. Usually they think they're contacting a woman, and they'll say something like, hey, remember me? We met at this party a couple months ago, and, you know, you, or me, the person who receives this message, responds, I think you've got the wrong number. I'm not that person. And that's all. And they write back and they say, oh, sorry to bother you. But then they try to strike up a conversation. And I can tell it's a scam. And I'll sometimes, if I'm bored, I mean, if I'm in a hurry or whatever, I'll just block them. But if I'm bored or if I'm feeling cantankerous or mischievous, I'll string them along. But it's always the same thing. They always claim, you know, that they were reaching out to somebody that they actually know in real life, usually a woman. As soon as you tell them, I'm not that person, they apologize, they try to strike up a conversation, and that, invariably, is when they send, unsolicited, a photograph of the person, you know, they supposedly are, which I'm sure they are not. And it's always a young, like, late 20s, professional-looking Asian woman. There's no flirting, there's nothing, you know, there's no implied sexual connotations, nothing like that. They're just playing on their attractiveness. And, you know, I've never given them the right responses to the point where, you know, they actually make their pitch, but I have since researched this pattern. And yeah, they're selling, they're not selling, they're trying to get you to invest in particular crypto products. But one of the aspects of the invented personality that they're projecting is that they are very successful. Like some of these, one, maybe even the first one, who contacted me, and I, this first person I actually took to be a real person, she told me that her assistant had probably put the wrong number in her phone, you know, for this person she said she was trying to contact. So this all happens on my phone, and I'm not going to try to hold my phone in my hand and talk into the microphone here. But just yesterday, for the first time, it happened on Telegram rather than on WhatsApp. And the pattern is a little different here in that the, you know, the fake profile is supposedly a middle-aged white woman named Millie Sutton. I like to play Minecraft. I'm interested in crypto. There's a project called The Uplift, which is basically Minecraft servers where you have to go and buy a deed to a piece of land before you can build on that land in the Minecraft world. And the deed takes the form of a non-fungible token or an NFT. So there is a crypto connection to The Uplift, but it's kind of tangential. Really, it's a Minecraft project. You know, it's a shared online experience where people build stuff together and interact, you know, in the Minecraft world, or using Minecraft as like a game engine. And so I am a member of the Uplift.world official announcements and the Uplift, the official Uplift group on Telegram. And so she reached out to me, not claiming to be, you know, contacting somebody else and accidentally getting me, but she writes, hello, I contacted you from the Uplift group chat. Please, are you making profit from the platform? So this tells me immediately that she's a scammer. And I'm saying she because, you know, the avatar is a woman. It could easily be a man, you know, sitting in a sweatshop in probably in the Philippines with 30 different old cell phones like strapped down to a big board, and he or she is conducting multiple conversations at once and not really doing a very good job at keeping in mind what has already been said in this particular conversation. So always when you hear me say Millie Sutton, put Millie Sutton in quotes, because this is an avatar. This is an alias. Millie writes, hello, I contacted you from the Uplift group chat. Please, are you making profit from the platform? And I responded, hi, no, I haven't logged into the Uplift in a long time. Millie continues, I joined the group recently. What do you think about the platform? Is it a legit one? I responded, what do you mean? Millie says, I'm talking about the group chat we share together, the Uplift group. Do you invest there? To which I responded, and this is key. You know, she should have read this and just checked out. I responded, the Uplift is a multiplayer Minecraft game. You buy land in the form of an NFT, and then you can build on that land. Do you play Minecraft? Millie responds, oh, I thought it an investment platform. I responded, Who told you that? Millie responds, I was randomly added to the group. I thought it was an investment group chat. Thanks for the information. I really appreciate. Are you into any platform or do you invest in any platform? Why do you ask? Because I am an investor. I want to know if you are into any investment platform. I responded, why do you want to know about my investments? Millie continues, maybe I could diversify my investments for maximum earnings. I responded, you're asking financial advice from a random stranger? To which Millie responded, I love diversifying my investments. You know, it's not advisable to put all your eggs in one basket so you don't lose all your money in investments as nothing is 100% guaranteed. So that's obviously a cut and paste because it's the, you know, the longest post she's made and it is grammatically correct. She continues, sorry for disturbing you with my question. I just noticed that we share the same group. That's why I decided to ask. So I thought she said groups plural and I said, which groups? And she says, the Uplift. To which I responded, the group to which you were randomly added? She responds, yes. I want to invest, so I am trying to find out if you have any now you can recommend me that you trust. To which I responded, pull the other one, Millie, and I put Millie in quotes. To which Millie responded, what do you mean? Is the Millie an investment platform? To which I responded, what's your first name? So when I said, pull the other one, Millie, Millie thought that maybe my use of Millie was some other investment platform. Anyway, at that point, Millie realized that, you know, she's been found out and didn't contact me again. That was at 11:20 p.m. last night. So crypto, you don't even have to be invested in crypto products. I mean, if you just start participating in discussions online, you know, in group forums about crypto, scammers will flock to you like flies. It's an environment that is rife with criminality. And I think Cory Doctorow really puts his thumb on it when he talks about the anonymity and pseudonymity that is just ubiquitous in crypto. It allows scammers to run the same scam over and over again. He says, you know, learning from their mistakes as they start over, but they don't even have to learn from their mistakes. I mean, I'm getting this exact same approach time and again. Like, somebody clearly sold my email address, actually phone number in the case of WhatsApp, to a scammer list. I'm guessing it's because I was on Filipino Cupid for a month. That's my best guess, you know, as to why somebody thinks I'm going to be susceptible to a pretty young Asian woman, you know, contacting me seemingly by mistake and then getting into a casual conversation about investments. But they're not sophisticated. It's like the, you know, the Nigerian prince letters. Send me a little bit of money so that I can take care of some administrative business. And then I'm going to send you a big chunk of this fortune that, you know, is the inheritance of this Nigerian prince. I haven't gotten one of those in, gosh, probably years. I used to get them regularly as email. You know, I mentioned that I hadn't gotten one of those Nigerian prince email, you know, scam emails in years, and I wondered if they were still going around. So I just did a quick search, and here's an NBC article. Nigerian prince email scams still rake in over $700,000 a year. Here's how to protect yourself. Well, I won't be reading this. You don't need to know how to protect yourself against those. Just ignore them. Simple as that. But in general, if somebody is appealing to your greed, being greedy, really, it short circuits critical thinking, as does lust, as does anger. So typically somebody who's trying to get money out of you, you know, directly, like they want you to write them a check or send them some money, they're not going to use anger. But lust and greed, oh, those are just golden methods. When I was getting ready to leave the United States, shortly after 9/11, I anticipated that the government response to 9/11 was going to be draconian. And I thought it best to get out of the U.S. And that's when I planned to go to Costa Rica, but somehow ended up in Australia. But as I was getting ready to leave the country, I needed to sell a newish expensive vehicle. It was a RX 300, which is a Lexus SUV, but a luxury SUV. You know, this is fresh off my my Amazon winnings. And I listed it for sale on a car, you know, a website that sells cars. And this was in, you know, the year 2002, I think. And, you know, this wasn't very sophisticated yet. But I got an email from somebody who claimed to be working in Los Angeles. And he seemed like he was very busy, like he was dashing off this email. And he said, yeah, just send me the VIN and a copy of the title and we can get this done today. Like, you know, very, very brusque, very businesslike, like this is nothing to him. And I sent him the VIN. I didn't send him a photograph of the title, but he took the description of the vehicle along with the VIN and he put it up. He created, I think it was an eBay auction for the vehicle, and he listed it at a ridiculously low price. And I found out about this when the person who actually bought that vehicle via the auction contacted me to say, hey, where's the vehicle? And I'm like, well, you know, what are you talking about? And he asked me, you know, if he starts asking me about the vehicle. He said, did it ever hit a deer? I said, well, it hit an antelope. And, you know, we were on the phone when I said that. And when he heard that, he's like, oh, well, yeah, this is the car, but you know, aren't you KMO? And I said, yeah, that's me. And then, you know, as we get into it, he forwards to me the email correspondence that he had supposedly with me. But clearly it was with this guy who claimed that, you know, he was ready to buy the vehicle from me. All he needed was the VIN and a copy of the title. And so when I started looking into this, you know, how did this guy fall for this? Because this was a guy, just a family man, not some rich guy. And, you know, he thought that this was a vehicle that would hold its value pretty well. And it was a good price that it was being offered at. And, you know, he said that he had sent the money to an escrow company, which was going to hold it until he received the vehicle. And he sent me the website for the escrow company. And I looked at it, and it's a very professional looking website on the main page. But all the links just led back to the main page. So when I'm looking at it, you know, without the greed goggles on, just, you know, digging into this, I can see that this is a fake website. But at the same time, I can see it's very professionally produced. And if you are motivated to believe that it's real, you could easily believe that it is real. So I felt bad for this guy. He'd sent like $17,000 to this so-called escrow site, which was really just a foreign bank account. He would never see that money again. I called the FBI to report this. The FBI did not want to hear about it. Why did I start with the FBI and not my local police department? Well, what are the local police going to do about it? For one, you know. But two, this is a multi-state, multinational crime. You know, this is well outside the jurisdiction of any local police department. But the FBI wouldn't even take a report. They were absolutely not interested in hearing about it. They told me to report it to my local police department. I reported it to my local police department and they took the report. But, you know, the guy I talked to is just shrugs. It's like, you know, I don't know how any of this stuff works. This, again, is in 2002. Lots of people that, you know, normal, everyday professional people didn't even have email at that time. Yeah. So the local police were absolutely clueless. They took the report, but they had no idea what to do with it. I can understand why the FBI didn't want to hear about it. One, you know, from their perspective, it's absolutely petty. But if I report it to them and they don't solve it, well, you know, those metrics do get tabulated and reported. If they're receiving multiple reports of these types of crimes and none of them actually get resolved, you know, none of these cases get closed, well, that looks bad for them. So they just refuse to take the report. They don't want to hear about it. So the point there being, if the guy who actually tried to buy my car and sent his money to some Eastern European so-called holding company, you know, or escrow company, if he hadn't been motivated by the desire to grab this really good deal, if he'd been in a more neutral state of mind, just investigating this, suppose he'd been assigned to investigate this as part of his job, he probably would have recognized, oh, this is nonsense. But it was the greed and the greed is such an ugly word. But what I'm talking about here is the artificial time pressure that a good deal introduces to you psychologically. You know, if you don't grab it right now, it's going to go away and you want it and you don't want to see that it's fake. you know? So that is rampant in crypto. And, you know, it's hard to blame people who work selling the hours of their lives for decades. And by the end of it, the amount that they have managed to put aside is trivial compared to the amount by which some, you know, 20-year-old's crypto portfolio balance fluctuates from day to day as the price of Bitcoin rises and falls. To see people who don't seem like they're hardworking, who don't seem like they're particularly smart or moral, to see them getting rich while you, the hardworking sucker, you know, at the end of your career is looking at a so-called retirement, which is really going to be enforced poverty, it's in no way surprising that somebody in that situation wants to get a piece of the easy money, which seems to be flowing to all these other people. And in that situation, yeah, they are going to fail to see what they would otherwise see if they weren't in the grip of that short-term, I got to get this before it disappears mentality. Okay, time to bring this in for a landing. I was like half an hour into some long ramble when an alarm went off letting me know that it was time for me to get online and record a conversation. And I recorded a conversation with a guy named Jimmy D, who lives, he's Canadian, but he lives in Japan. He's about to move back to Canada for the first time in 20 years. And he is involved in the Uplift, which is this blockchain-based Minecraft, you know, multiplayer world that I've been involved in for a while. And their company, you know, it was started by this guy named Corey, who's very idealistic, but he was in business with some real cutthroat people who basically just fired his whole team with zero notice. And Corey is like, no, this isn't going to fly. And he raised millions of dollars and, you know, in a short period and used it to buy the whole project back from the parent organization. And, you know, they even took some of the money. They created a DAO, a distributed autonomous organization, to govern the, you know, the newly liberated Uplift world. And some of the money that he'd raised, you know, to buy the whole organization back from the parent company, there was some money left over, and he distributed that to the players, you know, and the members of the DAO. It's funny, when I say the DAO, it's like a T-A-O. You know, like the DAO that can be named is not the true DAO. This is DAO, and it's Distributed Autonomous Organization. But, you know, when I asked Jimmy to basically give an encapsulation of how he got into blockchain and distributed organizations and whatnot, he started off by talking about how he got involved in permaculture. You know, here's a guy who is up to his eyeballs in blockchain. That's his livelihood. But when you ask him about what motivates him, you know, he starts off talking about permaculture and what got him into permaculture. And he talks about time spent in Hawaii, teaching school there and seeing kids, you know, come to school every day who are homeless. And it's, you know, their parents are employed, you know, dad's got three jobs, mom's got two jobs, but they live in a tent on the beach because they just can't afford property in Hawaii, the place where they were born. And they can't afford property there because it's such a beautiful place. And people come from all over the world with lots of money to buy a piece of it. And it prices out the locals. You know, so these are the concerns that are motivating Jimmy. But if, you know, if you're Blue Tribe and you're anti-crypto, and the only thing that you know about him is that he works in crypto and he's involved in a distributed autonomous organization around a massively multiplayer online world, well, you would probably make some untrue and unfair assumptions about his motivations and his character and his even his political philosophy. And I talked to him about scams, you know, because he's a very idealistic person. He's working with other idealistic people, but he's working in a space which is just rife with predatory behavior, dishonest, dissimulation, a word I picked up just recently from Curtis Yarvin. Dissimulation is concealment of one's thoughts, feelings, or character. And, you know, crypto is full of dissimulation. You know, as I've described, I get contacted every day, pretty much, by people who are looking to prey upon what they assume my psychological weaknesses are in order to get me to reveal information that will allow them to rob me. Every single day, somebody reaches out to me to do that. And it's not because I'm a podcaster. It's because I'm associated with various discussions in various different places about cryptocurrency projects. So to say that, you know, cryptocurrency and the blockchain scene in general has a scammer problem, it's not only true, it's an understatement. And I asked Jimmy about that. And his position was that, you know, the world is full of scammers, that all manner of monetary exchanges and anywhere where there is a weakness, anywhere where there is a vulnerability, people will exploit it. And I think that's right. It's just that the crypto space is so half-formed, it is protean, and it's also built by and for very technical people. And when non-technical people get into that space, they are bewildered and out of their depth from the get-go, and the place is just full of predators waiting to take advantage of that disorientation. It's nasty. I absolutely agree. No pushback from me on that, you know, on the statement, the, to my mind, self-evidently true statement that crypto has a scammer problem writ large. But it's also a space filled with very idealistic people. It's just a lot of the idealism tends toward decentralization and personal autonomy, which, you know, these are offensive concepts to somebody who wants to preserve the coercive power of the government because they want to seize it and see it set to enforcing their worldview, as opposed to the current, you know, the worldview of the oligarchs. So I just deleted that half hour ramble that I told you I had recorded. In it, I talked a bit about the extreme nastiness that just went down in Texas and, you know, online as a result. I don't want to revisit that. And in all honesty, I mean, do you want to hear me talk about it? Haven't you heard enough? Is anybody saying anything to really change your mind? Anyway, I'm going to wrap this up. As always, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for continuing to listen to a podcast which, by design, is not reinforcing your prior commitments and isn't even consistent. Like, I make no pledge whatsoever to be consistent in the future with anything that I've said in this podcast. I reserve the right to think differently in the future and to speak differently. But what I need to do right now is stop speaking, start editing, get this thing posted. I'll talk to you again soon. Stay well.